chapter 2 at verse 11 tonight. Let us spend a moment in prayer. We're grateful, Father, for the opportunity of meeting here together tonight in this place where we frequent so often to study the Word of God. And we're grateful for the Word itself, for the living Word and the written Word about the living Word. And we ask that you will open to us the Word of life tonight as we study, that our minds may be alert and our spirits may be receptive, our understanding may be keen, that we will receive the message which you have for us in these ancient words which have meant so much to the church and the people of God through the centuries before. These things we ask in the name of Christ. Amen. We were discussing the hiding of Moses in the bulrushes in the Nile River when we concluded our session on last Thursday evening. And that brings us to verse 11 of chapter 2. And it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out unto his brethren and looked on their burdens, and he observed an Egyptian smiting an Hebrew, one of his brethren. And he looked this way and that way, and when he saw that there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together, and he said to him that did the wrong, "Wherefore smitest thou thy fellow?" And he said, "Who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou didst kill the Egyptian?" And Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses, but Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "How is it that you are come so soon today?" And they said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds, and also drew water enough for us and watered the flock." And he said unto his daughters, "And where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses Zipporah his daughter. And she bore him a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been an alien in a foreign land." If you read St. Stephen's speech to the Sanhedrin just before his martyrdom, recorded in the 7th chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, St. Stephen tells us without any equivocation that Moses was 40 years old when this happened. That's the only real insight we have into that. We know that Moses was brought up in the royal courts as the adopted, more or less adopted, son of Pharaoh's daughter. And when he was 40 years old, then it was that he began to visit among the people of Israel who were in bondage in Egypt and began to see their plight. So we are grateful for that one little statement in the 7th chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, which gives us this information about the age of Moses at this time. He spent the first 40 years of his life in the royal courts in Egypt, and the second 40 years of his life in the fields of Midian, where he tended the sheep of his father-in-law Jethro, and where he married the daughter of Reuel, and where he had a son. And then it was when he was 80 years old that he returned into Egypt and began his laborious task of delivering the children of Israel from Egyptian bondage. So that's where we are tonight. We are at his 40th year. It came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out unto his brethren and looked on their burdens, and he observed an Egyptian smiting an Hebrew, one of his brethren. Now the question that immediately comes to your mind when you read this verse is, if Moses knew that the Israelites in bondage were his brethren, even though he was being reared in the royal courts by Pharaoh's daughter and had advantage of all of the luxuries and the niceties of the royal court, if this is so, why is it that he waited until he was 40 years old before he went out to survey the situation among his brethren? It could be that he was not permitted to do so. We do not know what the laws and legalities of the Egyptian royal court may have been at that time. It may be that Moses, even though he knew these were his brethren, was so immersed and enmeshed in the life of the court and the Egyptians where he was reared, that he actually didn't have time or disposition to do so. It is quite possible that it was not until he was 40 years of age that he matured enough to realize his responsibility to the people who were being oppressed by the Egyptian Pharaoh. We do not know for sure, but that is a question which automatically rises as to why he had remained reticent and silent for this 40 years of his life. Now, when he came to look on his brethren and to observe their burdens and to be grieved about their oppression, he saw something that he did not like. And in a rash fit of temper, he did something he should not have done. He looked this way and that way, and when he saw that there was no man, that is, he was very careful that nobody was looking, or at least he thought nobody was looking, before he committed this deed of murder, he slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Apparently what was happening here was one of the Egyptian taskmasters over the Hebrews was making life a bit difficult for one of the Hebrew brethren. That was not at all unusual. In fact, we even commented on that fact last week when we talked about the fact that the taskmasters made life rigorous for the people of Israel, which means that they laid the whip to their backs and across their bare legs. And they forced them to work in the heat of the sun without clothing. And they forced them to find straw to make their own brick. It was an impossible task which was laid upon them. All day in the heat of the sun until late at night. Day after day after day without any respite or any rest. And so here one of the taskmasters probably is complaining because this Hebrew has not been doing his task as he thinks he should. And so, like many of the southern plantation owners of a century ago, he laid the whip upon him, and Moses did not like what he saw. And when he went out on the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together, and he said to him that did the wrong, "Why do you smite your fellow? Why do you fight with your brother? This is not your enemy. Your enemy is the royal court and the Egyptians. We know that now. And your fellow Hebrews are not your enemies. Why are you fighting among yourselves?" This has always been a problem with God's people. It's still a problem in the church today, where we find ourselves constantly at odds with each other because of our varied beliefs and dispositions, and we find ourselves fighting and destroying what ought to be unity within the church of God. And yet, how do you avoid that when our beliefs sometimes are so different and we're forced to live together in the same kind of community? It's very difficult to avoid that. It was difficult for Moses when he saw this brash treatment that was ministered to someone whom he ought to love and certainly did respect because he was a part of his own community of faith. And he said, "Who made thee a prince and a judge over us?" Well, clearly, the Hebrews must have known that Moses was considered a prince because he was the adopted son of an Egyptian princess, which would have made him a prince of sorts. And so this Hebrew, when he was chastised or chagrined by Moses, said to him, "Who made you a prince over us? Who gave you this right? What kind of legal authority do you have over us? You may be an Egyptian prince, but you have nothing to do with us. You haven't had anything to do with us for 40 years. So the Hebrews who are quarreling with each other are really quarreling with Moses here, and it may be partly because he has not shown any consideration for them in this long period of 4 decades. "Who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" And Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." So the news was out. People knew that he had killed the Egyptian on the preceding day. At least this Hebrew did. And Moses added 2 and 2 and came up with 4. And he said, "If this Hebrew knows that I did that yesterday in secret when I looked both ways and nobody was looking, if he knows that I did this, then others know it, and perhaps it's even known in the royal court." And so he was afraid. He was afraid because he knew he had done wrong. He was afraid because he knew he would have to pay for his crime in Egypt. He knew that he had disobeyed what he may have understood as God at this time, and we're not sure how developed that concept of God may have been, but he may have known. Because I do not believe that we're born into a world, whether we're among primitive cults or whether we're in more cultured civilization, I do not believe that anybody is born without some concept of right and wrong. And as we grow up, we develop that concept, either negatively or positively, but we all have that ingrained into our nature. That's what Paul is talking about in the opening chapters of the letter to the Romans, when he talks about the law of nature. And then he talks about the law of God, which has been given in the oracles of the Ten Commandments. And then he talks about the grace of God, which has given us a brand new law of freedom. Well, he talks about three kinds of laws or conscience that we have. And so I think everybody has this. I think Moses had this, and I'm sure that he was inwardly, subconsciously at least, aware that what he had done was wrong. And so he was afraid. He was afraid of what concept he had of God. He was afraid of the Egyptian authorities. He probably was afraid of Pharaoh himself. For certainly Pharaoh, being the legal authority par excellence in the land of Egypt, would not allow this kind of thing to go. He might have permitted Moses to kill that Hebrew, but he wouldn't permit him to kill that Egyptian. And so Moses is afraid. I think he is also afraid because he knows somehow in his subconscious, though he has not been told directly this by God yet, he knows that somehow he was born to be a peacemaker. Isn't that why at 40 years of age he has gone out to see about his brethren, to see how they're doing? I think he somehow knew that. And later when God called him at the burning bush, it was only confirmation of what in his own mind he had known from the very beginning, or at least from an early age in his life. But he could not be a peacemaker now because he had committed a grievous crime. Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses, but Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. We know a little bit about the legalities of the Egyptian people of that time, and we do know one thing. We know that this kind of lifestyle was not permitted. There was no such thing as manslaughter. It was murder. Pure and simple, it was murder. Today we have so many ways by which to detour around the law, as you all know. And our legal system is in shambles. And today a man can kill somebody in cold-blooded murder and still he can get off with a lesser sentence of manslaughter. You didn't do that in Egypt. If you killed somebody, it was murder. And you died for what you had done. And of course it was very much that way later on in the nation of Israel, as we discover from the books of law in the Old Testament. So he fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. Now Midian was southeast of the Delta and the Goshen area where the children of Israel lived, up near the sea. Southeast would have been down in the area near to what we know as Mount Sinai, not quite that far because they have to travel to get there, but it was in that area, Midian. Now who were these people of Midian? The Midianites were descendants of Abraham by his wife Keturah, whom he married after his wife Sarah died. That's told to us in the book of Genesis. After he married Keturah, and when we were studying Genesis a long time ago, I remember distinctly making a comment that the guy was getting rather old, but he married this woman when he was old, and then he had a whole bunch of kids. A whole bunch of them. And one of them mentioned there is Midian. So Midian, the descendant of Abraham and Keturah, was the father of the Midianites. The Midianites were the travelers who passed through the desert and took Joseph and sold him down into Egypt. You remember? They were Midianites, which means that they were kinfolk. They were related. They were like second or third cousins to one another. So Moses here, when he goes to dwell among the Midianites, is not dwelling among a foreign people. He's dwelling among Midianites who are not Hebrews, but they are second, third, fourth cousins down the way. That's important, because when we discover a little later that Jethro and Reuel are priests of the Most High God in Midian, we realize that being descendants of Abraham, they had something akin to the faith which Moses would have had as a Hebrew had he been reared by his mother instead of by the Egyptian court. So, is it possible, and this is only supposition, is it possible that while Moses had been reared for 40 years in the Egyptian court, had been taught the Egyptian language, the Egyptian culture, he'd been taught how to read Egyptian and write Egyptian, He had been taught mathematics, he had been taught geometry, he had been taught all of the sciences of the Egyptians, and they were very brilliant people. Is it possible that during all that period he had never had much teaching about Jehovah? He had maybe forgotten all about Abraham. And is it possible that when he went to dwell with Reuel in Midian, that Reuel told him some of the stories about his ancestor Abraham, because Reuel was a priest of the Midianites, and certainly he would have been a religious man. Now that is conjecture, I'm sure, but I think probably that certainly may have happened. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their flocks. And the shepherds came and drove them away. That is to say, they were rude, because the law, the unwritten law, but the understood law among the shepherds in the deserts of the eastern world at that time was that whoever was there first watered their sheep or their camels or their oxen, whatever they had first, and they took turns. But these shepherds, seeing the seven women come to water their sheep, these shepherds were rude and they drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "How is it that you are come so soon today?" Incidentally, the word Reuel means friend of God. He's a Midianite. He's a priest, a Midianite priest. And they said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds." Probably they recognized him as an Egyptian because of his dress and because of his speech, which he had learned to speak fluently in the land of Egypt. "And also drew water enough for us and watered the flock. And he said unto his daughters, 'And where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread.'" Because this was one of the most grievous sins that an Easterner, an Oriental, could commit. And that is inhospitable treatment of a stranger. If a stranger came, you always invited him into the house. You set food before him. You washed his feet for his journey. That was just the way you did things. And to not do that was a grievous lack of courtesy. And Moses was content to dwell with the man, that is with Reuel, and he gave Moses Zipporah his daughter, and she bore him a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been an alien in a foreign land." And when you read those two verses, it sounds like this all happened the first day. You know, that he arrived in Midian, and he went down to the house of Reuel, the Midianite priest. And Reuel liked him very much, and he said, "Hey, would you like to have my daughter Zipporah?" And he said, "Sure." And that night they had a son named Gershom. It all just happens right together. But obviously we know that that's probably not what happened, because it does say that he was content to dwell with Reuel in Midian. So he had probably been there a while before Zipporah was given to him for a wife and before Gershom was born. And he named him Gershom, which means strange. Did you ever have a strange son, or know anybody that had a strange son? He had a strange son. He named him Strange because he had been an alien in a foreign land. The son wasn't strange. He named him Strange because he was a stranger himself in the land of Midian. And it came to pass in process of time that the king of Egypt died. Now, Moses didn't know he was waiting for that, but he was. And the children of Israel did know they were waiting for that, because they kept thinking, if this king ever dies, maybe we'll have a new man on the throne who will not be so rough on us. Maybe he'll treat us a little better. But they were terribly, terribly, terribly confused if they thought that, because when the new king came, he was worse than the other one. It came to pass in process of time that the king of Egypt died. And at this time now, Moses would have been 80 years old, because he's about to be called into the land to deliver the children of Israel. There's a similar story in the New Testament. You remember when King Herod decided he was going to kill all the boy babies, and the mother and father of Jesus took him and ran down to Egypt? You remember that? And when they heard that Herod had died, then they returned? Very similar story. And the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage. I think the reason they were sighing was because they had expected perhaps some leverage when he came to the throne. Didn't happen. And they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And all the way through the Old Testament, the writers of the Old Testament speak about God as though he were a big man. This is what we call anthropomorphism. It's treating God as if he were a big man. And how else do you describe God than to say God is like us, only he's a lot bigger and he's more powerful and he's more loving and he's more everything, you know, but he's like us. Because he created us in his own image. He must be something like us. And so they talk about God in these terms. God remembered. As if God had forgotten and all of a sudden he remembered the children of Israel. How else can you describe that? Other than simply to talk about God as if he were a big man. He remembered. That's the way we would do it. We remembered that there was a problem, so we went to see about it. He remembered his covenant. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God knew their plight. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. You know that old spiritual, oh, that is so wrong. Somebody does know the trouble we've seen and the trouble we have, and somebody is concerned, and somebody is always looking in, and somebody is waiting for the proper time in his own divine economy to do something about it. And someday our troubles and our problems will all be worked out by God, and we'll be relieved of them. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. That's an interesting statement, because the first time we've heard about Jethro, we heard that he married Zipporah, the daughter of Reuel, and now it says Jethro is his father-in-law. I thought Reuel was his father-in-law. What's going on here? Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. I thought Reuel was the priest of Midian. Remember now, some years have passed, because he's been in the wilderness 40 years, and he's now ready to go back. So probably what has happened here is Reuel, the high priest, has died, and Jethro... Jethro, every time I come across that word in the Bible, it makes me laugh, because I think of, wasn't it Jethro on the... Yeah, right. Jethro is a son of Reuel, who has died, and Jethro has taken his father's place, so that Jethro is now the high priest. And the word that is used here for father-in-law is what I would call a generic term. It simply means a relation. And sometimes this word is translated not father-in-law, sometimes it's translated brother-in-law, sometimes just translated father, because they weren't very particular about these things, and this was a generic term. So what we have here is really not his father-in-law, but his brother-in-law, who was like his father-in-law because he had taken his father-in-law's position as high priest, and that meant that he had authority over Moses, just like a father-in-law should have authority over his son-in-law. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the desert, which was the more fertile side of the desert, and came to the mountain of God, even the Horeb. The mountain of God would have been the Sinai mountain range. The fact that Horeb is mentioned is because Horeb was the name of the whole mountain range, and Sinai was simply one small group of mountains in the range of Horeb. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire. Now remember that term, the angel of the Lord. I'll come back to it in just a minute. And we have come across that expression again and again in the book of Genesis. And we talked about it at length there. The angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. He was not only attracted, he was mesmerized by what he saw. Because what he saw had not been seen before by him nor anyone else that we know of. He saw a bush or a tree aflame. And as he stood and watched it, it was obvious that it was burning with intense heat and brightness, but it wasn't being consumed. So he knew that there was something ominous about this place. It reminds me of Jacob, when Jacob arrived at Bethel. And he saw this ladder let down out of heaven from God, the angels of God ascending and descending upon it. You remember what he said? He said, how dreadful is this place? This is none other than the house of God. How dreadful is this place? And normally we wouldn't think of using the word dreadful to refer to God, but God is full of dread. And that's why we reverence him. We respect him. We fear him. Because he is full of dread. Fear and reverence, of course, mean the same thing in the scripture. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses, and he said, here am I. Now notice something very important. It says, angel of the Lord. Right? In verse 2, it says, the angel of the Lord. Then in verse 4 it says, when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses, and he said, here am I. Now the word Lord here in the Hebrew language is the word Jehovah. It is actually the word Yahweh, but we transliterate it as Jehovah. And the word God in verse 4 is the word Elohim. It is actually El, which is God, and then Ohim, which makes it plural, so that God, in the generic sense of God, is referred to in the Old Testament in the plural because he is all the God there is. Therefore, he is referred to in the plural because there's no way to add anything to him. He's all the gods merged into one. Now, you remember in our last session, I talked to you a bit at the outset about the JEPD theory, which was advanced by Wellhausen and his friends in Germany almost 75 or so years ago, in which it was said, without any evidence, simply from higher critical analysis of the scripture, it was said by Wellhausen and his scholarly friends in Germany that the Torah, the Pentateuch, the five books of the law of the Old Testament, were not written by Moses. They were written much later by several people. There was one person who used the word Jehovah when he wrote his story. And there was another person who used the word Elohim when he wrote his story. And one of them came from the northern kingdom and one came from the southern kingdom. And then later, about 500 years before the coming of Christ, the priest put this all together in what was called the priestly code. And so we have J-E-P symbolizing the two writers plus the priest who put together all of the Torah, which takes away all of the miraculous aura which surrounds the first five books of the Bible. That has not been totally repudiated, but it doesn't have much following anymore among people today. But at the time it came out, everybody just, all the other scholars just grabbed it up because these men were so smart they couldn't make a mistake, even though they had no evidence for this whatsoever. It was simply pure intellectual conjecture on their part. And we've seen this happen again and again and again. Now here, two or three things need to be said. One is, we have in one verse here the word Jehovah and the word Elohim, J and E, the two different writers according to Wellhausen and his scholarly friends. That can't be, because it's in one sentence that both names for God are used. So you don't have two different writers of one sentence in the book of Genesis. That's just not what they were saying. They were saying different sections of it were written by these different authors. And so I think that helps to discount that whole theory. But the other thing, which is more important than that, is the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament, who appeared to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and now appears to Moses in the burning bush, the angel of the Lord is the second person of the Trinity, whose spirit was the creator of the world. We're taught this in the New Testament in several places, especially in John's prologue to his gospel, in the first 14 verses of the first chapter of John. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. Not anything was made that was made without the Word, which is Jesus Christ, the Word of God. So Jesus Christ existed long before Bethlehem, and he's eternal because he's a part of the Godhead, and he is the angel of the Lord who appeared again and again in his pre-incarnate visage to these saints, these special saints of the Old Testament. This is the Lord Jesus Christ who appears here to Moses in the burning bush. And how do I know the angel of the Lord is not just an angel, but is God? It's because in verse 4, where the angel of the Lord is referred to again, it says, when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush. So in other words, the angel of the Lord, Jehovah and Elohim, are all one and the same. Jesus Christ is identified, even at this early stage in the Old Testament, with Jehovah and with Elohim both in these few verses in Exodus. Now this is very important exegesis, as we call it. And I think it's very important theology to understand this, because the scriptures say so much more than we normally gather from them. And the Lord saw that he turned aside to see Jehovah. When Jehovah saw that he turned aside to see, Elohim called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, and he said, here am I. Now why these two names, incidentally? God had other names in the Old Testament. For example, El Shaddai over in Genesis. God said to Abraham, when Abraham had sort of messed things up by getting involved with Hagar and having a son he wasn't supposed to have, you remember? And God said to him, Abraham, 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 I am El Shaddai. I am the Almighty One. I didn't need your help. If you just waited, I would have done what I promised. El Shaddai was another word that was used for God in the Old Testament. They had a lot of names for God. This was probably the earliest name, and the one that just means gods. And then Yahweh was a name later given to the Israelites, but given back in the days of Abraham, because it's mentioned there, which was a kind of favored name for God among the Hebrews, a special name for God, their God, Jehovah. But in a minute, we're going to find out that God has another name, which is even more important than that, and God says so himself. And he said, draw not near here, but put off your shoes or your sandals from off your feet, for the place whereon you stand is holy ground. If you go into the Middle East today, if you go to Egypt today, and you go into one of the mosques, you will have to take off your shoes or your sandals and go in. They'll let you sometimes put on some little cloth slippers, but you have to take off your shoes because they're dirty. They have the soil of the streets upon them, and this is holy ground. And this has been traditional now for all of these centuries. That's what was happening here. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, Elohim, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And then the Lord said, and that's Yahweh again, I am Elohim. And the Lord said, and Jehovah said, I am Elohim. I am the God of all the nations, but I am in particular Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, the God of your people. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and the God of Jacob. This is one of the early statements in the Old Testament which makes us know that God's people live after death. Because God is never referred to as the God of the dead. He is the God of the living. And he says here, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I am their God. They are all alive. One of our earliest insights in the fact that God's people live on after death. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, and I know their sorrows, and I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians. In the story in the 11th chapter of Genesis, where the people are building the Tower of Babel, it is said God came down to see what they were about. Here is that anthropomorphism again, where God is seen as a big man up in the sky somewhere, and he comes down, he condescends to see what we're doing down here, as if he didn't know. Well, obviously, the writer Moses didn't mean to imply that, but that's sort of what we gather from this. I'm come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land unto a large and good land, unto a land flowing with milk and honey. And that became a kind of a proverb later to refer to the land of Canaan. And still later, it became a proverb to refer to the heaven of the Christians. That's where we're going, to the land flows with milk and honey, the land of every good thing, heaven. And the Hittites and the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hevites, and the Jebusites. Now, who are all these ites that are mentioned here? I'm not going to try to describe or define each of them, but simply to say the Canaanites, that was a broad term which covered just about everybody in the land of Canaan. They were all Canaanites. And the Canaanites were the descendants of Canaan, who was the son of Ham, who was cursed by God, you remember, because of that, what we think was a homosexual episode referred to in the book of Genesis. So that's who the Canaanites are. And the Jebusites were simply heathen people who were probably half-breeds, mongrel-type people with the Canaanites, all of them living in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, behold, incidentally, the land of Canaan was promised to Abraham, and this is the way it was promised. If we had a map up here so you could see it better, and we don't, but since I am so good at drawing maps, this is the Great Sea, and up here is Israel, and on up here is Syria, and down here is Egypt, and over here is Iraq, and here is the Euphrates River, and here is the Nile River, and this is where the children of Israel were in bondage, but this is where they were going. And God promised to Abraham that he would give them descendants like the sands of the sea and the stars of the heavens, and he told them that he would give them an allotment of land, which would run from the Nile River in Egypt to the Euphrates River over here in Babylon, and it would run from Syria all the way down into the Negev. That would have been probably 450 miles long and 120 miles wide. There was a time when all of that belonged to the Hebrews, and that was during the reign of David and Solomon, the glory day of Israel. Never again did all of that belong to Israel. But we're told that in the end of the days, this will be theirs again. All that's very interesting. And I put the map up here because I think that is a little intriguing, and I think you ought to know that. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel is coming to me, and I have also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppress them. Come now therefore, and I will send thee unto Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. And Moses said unto God, Elohim, who am I? Now notice in verse 4, when he saw the burning bush and God spoke to him out of the bush, he said, Here I am. What do you want? And then when God began to speak to him, Moses said, who am I? He's just said, here I am. Now he says, but who am I? This man is a little confused, isn't he, right now? Here I am. I'm ready. What is it you want me? But who am I to do that? I don't know who I am. I just say here I am, but I don't know who I am. Who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? Now, why would he question that God would call him? Well, for two or three reasons, and he mentioned some of them later. One of them was he was just a poor shepherd. Why would God call a poor shepherd to go in and deliver the children of Israel? That wouldn't make much sense, Moses said. This is the way he's reasoning now with God. And also, remember, he's 80 years old, and even though 80 years old doesn't sound to us like very much in that ancient time, it was, by the time of Moses, a considerable age. He was 80 years old. A little bit old to take his walking stick and to go in and try to deliver the Israelites from Egyptian bondage. But, and later he mentions his speech problem too, but he was reared in the Egyptian palace. Who better prepared to deal with Pharaoh than someone who'd been reared in the Egyptian palace? And furthermore, he knew the language. Who better than someone who knew how to speak Egyptian to deal with Pharaoh? So God tries to offset his reasons for not going. He said, certainly I will be with thee, and this shall be a token unto thee that I have sent thee. When thou hast brought forth the people of Egypt, ye shall, out of Egypt, ye shall serve God upon this mountain. In other words, God is saying to him, you think you're not fit for this job when you're not. But I will be with you, and that makes you fit. God and one is a majority. If God is with you, you can do anything. If God is with you, you are fit for whatever God calls you to do. By yourself, you're a zero. By yourself, I'm a dud, a cipher. But with God, all things are possible. With me, you'll be fit to do this job. That's the first thing God says to him when Moses objects. And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. I think I skipped something here. Verse 13. And Moses said unto God, behold, when I come unto the children of Israel, and shall say unto them, the God of your fathers hath sent me unto you, and they shall say to me, what is his name? What shall I say unto them? Don't forget now that the children of Israel have been in bondage 400 years. 400 plus years. Most of them probably have forgotten all about the God of the Hebrews. Most of them at this time were bowing and worshiping the bull gods of Egypt. Because they had to. They were slaves. They were told what they had to do. They didn't remember much of that about the Hebrews. And the name of God, Moses says, when I tell them the God of the Hebrews sent me, they'll say, what's his name? We know about all these other gods in Egypt. We know their names, hear them all the time. What's his name? We don't know who he is. Now, there was El Shaddai, there was Jehovah, there was Elohim. They had lots of names, but they had forgotten all these names. So who is it? What is his name? What shall I say? And God said to Moses, I am that I am. And he said, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am hath sent me unto you. Now, God says, for all time and eternity, my name will be remembered and known by all people as I am that I am. What on earth does that mean? It means that God is the all-existent one. All of these so-called gods of the world, they don't even exist. They just exist in the projected images of men's minds. That's what we call projected religion. We project the idea of God as a result of what we think. Revealed religion is where God reveals himself to us as he did to Moses. It's one thing for God to say, this is who I am. It's another thing for me to say, I'm going to conjure up my own idea of what God is. And a lot of religion is based on the latter. In fact, a lot of Christians have that concept of God. It's a God of their own making. God is made in man's image rather than man made in God's image. Happens all the time. So God said, I am the existent God. I am the one who really exists. No other God, as the people think of them, exist. Isaiah says, what kind of people are you? You don't have any mind because you take a piece of wood and you use a part of it to build a piece of furniture, you use a part of it to heat your houses, and you use a part of it to make a God. A God who cannot reach out to you, a God who cannot hear you when you call, a God who cannot speak to you in your feel your pains. What kind of people are you? These gods don't exist. There is no such thing. Paganism is futility. Pagan gods are non-existent. But God says, I am that I am. I am the existent one. I am the timeless one. I am that I am. Not I was, I am, and I shall be, for with God there's no such thing as time. I was watching a program the other night, 2-hour program, on the life of Albert Einstein. I sat there and watched that. I was so engrossed, I couldn't move. I didn't know a thing that he was talking about, but I couldn't move. Because even though I didn't understand what he was saying about the theory of relativity and all of these high-sounding things that he discovered, I did know that Einstein was saying, in essence, there is nothing that is accidental in the world. There is nothing that is not planned. Everything is designed. And of course, you know that Albert Einstein was not deliberately very religious, though he says, yes, I am a religious man, but I have problems. But he knew that everything was designed, and he knew that God was timeless because he said time is a relative thing. That's a part of his theory of relativity. Time is a relative thing. There is no past. There is no future. There is only the eternal present. And Einstein wasn't the first one to discover that. God knew that way back here. He said, I am always. No past, no future, always in the present. The God who lives in the now. And that's why the Bible talks about foreknowledge and predestination and election and chosenness, because that is from God's perspective. And from us it means something different, but from God it is timelessness. So I am that I am means he's timeless. It means that he's real. He is a real God. And I discovered that when I became a Christian. I discovered that God is real. He's real. People today are searching everywhere for reality. No meaning in life. Everything is shades and shadows. No real substance. We're looking for something real. God is real, and God is the source of everything that is. I am that I am, and there is none beside me. And God said moreover unto Moses, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, who are all alive with me, hath sent me unto you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations. This is the way I want to be remembered by everybody forever. I am that I am. And we'll have to stop there because our time is gone.